Imagine you are tasked with designing the architectural foundation of the entire universe. What color are you painting the walls?
Well, I mean, if we look at historical precedent, you're going with sterile white clouds.
Right.
Maybe translucent gold streets, pearly gates, crystal seas,
Hmm.
you know, that classic untarnished celestial aesthetic.
Exactly, yeah. We expect this metallic crystalline perfection, completely separate from the dirt and biology of Earth.
Right, something very clean and detached.
But what if I told you the true foundation of reality isn't a bank vault of gold, but a massive, pulsating, radioactive green server room made entirely of emeralds?
I mean, it completely upends the traditional imagery, doesn't it? You're suddenly dealing with a universe that isn't built on rigid perfection.
No, not at all.
It's built on organic, biological vitality from the very first nanosecond of existence.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. If you're listening right now, whether you're our favorite longtime learner commuting to work, or you're just intensely curious about how abstract narratives can, bend our understanding of reality, you are in exactly the right place.
You really are.
Today, we are dissecting a highly intricate, genuinely mind-bending narrative called The Legend of Toivo and Elisa, the Green Gems, drawn from the writings of Topiholt too. And we really have to set the table here,
Yeah, we do.
because this isn't a standard, straightforward chronological fable.
Far from it. I mean, we are
Yeah.
looking at a tapestry that just smashes together universe-spanning creation myths, highly specific Scandinavian topography.
Oh, which is wild.
Totally wild.
Oh.
Apocalyptic warfare and this deeply intimate romance. And our objective today isn't merely to walk you through a plot summary.
No, we need to dissect the underlying physics of this universe. We're going to explore the specific color theory engineered into its foundation.
And the mechanics of how spiritual corruption actually physically rots reality.
Yes, and how a cosmic battle between light and dark collapses into a deeply personal love story. So let's start at the very beginning, the absolute genesis of this reality.
The literal first breath.
Right, and that word is key. Usually, Western creation myths rely on vocal command. A distant entity speaks, and reality obeys.
Let there be light.
Let there be light, exactly, and the photons align. It's an intellectual, almost clinical transaction. But HALT2's universe utilizes an entirely different mechanism. The creator here doesn't speak. The creator breathes.
And I think the distinction between the spoken word and the exhale of breath is, well, it's foundational.
How so?
Speech is external, right? It's a directive given to a void. But breath is profoundly intimate. When you breathe something into existence, you're expelling a piece of your own internal
Your
essence.
own life force.
Exactly. You're pushing it out into the physical plane. The biological mechanism of respiration is essentially being mapped onto the birth of the cosmos.
And what materializes from that divine exhale aren't abstract concepts or nebulous clouds. The breath condenses, it hardens, and forms visible, glowing emerald stones.
It's such a striking image.
They shine with a green brilliance that is explicitly identified as the color of life, forming a green foundation for paradise.
We really have to linger on that color choice for a second.
Yeah, the green is important.
Extremely, because across almost all human cultures, green is inextricably tied to flora, to photosynthesis, you know, to chlorophyll.
Right, to the aggressive, unstoppable engine of organic growth.
Yes. So by laying down emeralds as the bedrock of heaven, this narrative establishes that the divine is explicitly biological. It's living.
It fundamentally changes the relationship between the creator and the created, doesn't it? The divine isn't separate from nature. The divine is the raw, uncut blueprint of nature.
Exactly. And these emeralds aren't just decorative. The text says the creator places a light into them that reflects the eternal plan of his spirit.
Okay, wait, let's unpack this. It's like the creator is seeding a cosmic terrarium.
Yeah, a terrarium is a good way to look at it.
Instead of building a sterile realm of clouds, the blueprint of the universe is this glowing, radioactive green garden. But wait, if these stones hold the ultimate plan, are they basically the hard drives of this paradise?
They absolutely are. They function as cosmic hard drives. They contain the data, the code, the immutable destiny of everything that will ever exist, encoded directly into their crystalline structure.
Which instantly creates a massive philosophical friction.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, if the eternal plan is already locked into the molecular structure of these emeralds before a single angel or human even exists, we're looking at hard determinism.
Right, the script is already written.
But at the same time, it's a living green ecosystem, which implies organic growth and unpredictability. You have predestination running on biological hardware.
And the creator just doubles down on this friction. A green arc is cast above paradise, functioning as a covenant for all future life.
Okay, I have to push back on the logic of that. How do you establish a covenant like a binding legal or spiritual agreement when there is no second party?
That's the paradox.
Right, because there is no future life yet. It's just the creator and a server room of green stones. Who is signing the contract?
The contract is signed with potential. The creator is making a promise to the void itself.
Oh, interesting.
It's binding the architecture of the universe to a set of rules before anyone is there to experience them. It signals to the reader that this universe isn't arbitrary. It operates on a grand, pre-written cosmic architecture built on interconnectedness.
The takeaway here isn't just that green gems look cool. The core axiom is that in this universe, destiny isn't an abstract concept floating in the ether.
Right. Destiny is a physical geological object. You can touch the blueprint of reality.
But physicalizing destiny introduces a catastrophic vulnerability, doesn't it?
Massively.
If the absolute immutable plan of the universe is encoded into physical objects, you've just created the ultimate single point of failure. How does a creator secure a system like that?
Well, you don't just build a wall. You have to build an immune system.
Which brings us directly to the deployment of the Cosmic Guardians. Because a treasury filled with the source code of reality needs heavy security.
Definitely.
The text says three distinct angelic entities are molded, setting up a very deliberate division of heavenly labor.
It's a masterclass in establishing systemic stakes. First, you have the giant guardian angel, specifically appointed to watch over the emeralds.
So this is your security apparatus.
Exactly. Second, a fire angel, burning with highly specific colors, green, blue, orange, and red, deployed strictly to defend life. That's your military or immunological branch.
Okay, and the third.
Finally, the bright, white-clad singer angels, carrying a song in their hearts about the Creator's glory. They represent culture, art, and worship.
Vault security, active defense, and cultural resonance. The three pillars of a civilization. But here is the mechanism I cannot wrap my head around.
The free will aspect.
Yes. The Creator places a created soul with its own free will, specifically into the giant guardian angel. If you are engineering the ultimate security guard to protect the literal hard drives of reality, why would you program them with free will?
It's a huge question.
You want an unblinking automated machine. Free will inherently contains the algorithm for rebellion.
It is arguably the most controversial engineering choice possible. By injecting free will into the apex security apparatus, the creator intentionally introduces risk into an otherwise perfect system.
It seems reckless. I mean, a closed system without free will is mathematically safe.
Safe, yes, but entirely stagnant. The narrative argues here that the eternal plan encoded in those emeralds actually requires the variable of choice.
Requires it?
Yes. The creator is prioritizing the potential for genuine, chosen loyalty over automated robotic perfection. Because a love that cannot be withheld is not love, it's programming.
Oh, wow.
Therefore,
wow.
The capacity to destroy the universe must be granted to those guarding it.
I see the philosophical necessity, but man, it's a terrifying gamble. Let's look at the backup security then, the fire angel. The visual here is wildly specific.
You can tell my favorite details.
Right, because this isn't your standard medieval angel holding a flaming orange sword. The angel burns with green, blue, orange, and red flames. Why engineer a defensive angel with green and blue fire?
We have to apply the established color theory of this universe. Orange and red are traditional markers of consumption and destruction, you know, the martial aspect of defense.
Okay.
But green is the foundational color of the life-giving emeralds. Blue represents water and oxygen.
So the fire angel isn't just a weapon designed to burn threats.
No, it operates much more like an antibody. The fire is composed of the very elemental makeup of the life it's protecting. It's this aggressive, localized nebula designed to violently sustain the biological ecosystem.
That's fascinating.
It doesn't just destroy the enemy, it cauterizes and heals the wound simultaneously.
That completely reframes the nature of heavenly warfare. And contrasting that intense, multicolored inferno, we have the white-clad singer angels.
Right, the cultural wing.
Exactly. The lyrics encoded into their hearts explicitly state that the green stones reflect the Creator's glory. But then we get a crucial piece of prophetic foresight, the introduction of a living, green-eyed bride.
And this detail is dropped right into the Genesis sequence, eons before human beings or Earth even exists. The living green-eyed bride is the linchpin of the entire narrative structure.
The green eyes directly link her to the foundational emeralds. She's the biological culmination of the universe's hard drive.
Exactly.
It implies the ultimate goal of the cosmos isn't just existence, but a union, a courtship.
Which brings us to a synthesized axiom for this heavenly structure. A universe built for a wedding cannot be secured by robots. The risk of free will is the mandatory admission price for genuine intimacy.
And that intimacy requires a stage. The heavenly realm isn't meant to be a closed loop. It's a primary source meant to be projected. The creator commands the formation of an earth that deliberately reflects paradise.
The concept of earth as a reflection is vital.
Mm-mm.
It dictates that every physical phenomenon we experience is basically a secondary, denser manifestation of a spiritual reality.
So the physical world is just a shadow cast by the emeralds.
Exactly.
And the vocabulary used to describe this terraforming process is brilliant. Traditional elements are there, you know, separating light from formless darkness, dividing waters. But it specifically describes the creation of an ocean of oxygen.
That juxtaposition is jarring in the best way. Ocean invokes primordial myth, the chaotic deep of ancient cosmology, but oxygen, that is post-Enlightenment periodic chemistry.
Right.
Employs respiration, metabolism, cellular biology.
It refuses to silo science and spirituality. It forcefully marries the mythical poetry of creation with the molecular reality of existence.
It really grounds the high theology directly into the dirt and air. And look at the kinetic energy injected into the fauna.
Mm.
The narrative doesn't just list a catalog of animals.
Right, the verbs are very specific.
The whale sings, the dolphin leaps, the fish school. The birds fly free.
Every creature is assigned an action verb that denotes exuberance. The ecosystem isn't just functioning, it is actively expressing joy. The baseline operational state of this universe is unadulterated happiness.
Which makes the final addition to this earthly mirror so poignant. The text says the crown of creation is fashioned from the dust of the earth. But the motive is the key.
What's a motive?
It is done for the sake of a spouse's heart to share paradise.
The creator takes the most worthless, low-resolution material available dirt and elevates it to become the focal point of the cosmos purely for the desire of equal intimacy.
Not subjugation.
Partnership.
It's like Earth is the rough draft made of dust and water trying to perfectly mimic the high-definition, emerald-powered reality of heaven.
Built specifically to house this partnership. The foundational takeaway here is profound. Humanity wasn't created as a workforce or an afterthought. We were engineered from the dirt up to be the cosmic equivalent of a spouse, designed to share the joy of an oxygen-rich kinetic universe.
But a partnership based on free will is fragile. And the security apparatus designed to protect this entire system is about to trigger its own fail-deadly mechanism.
Yeah, because the first casualty in this universe doesn't happen on the dirt of Earth. It happens in the Emerald server room.
The absolute core.
A dark pride ignites in the heart of the giant guardian angel. And the motive is the oldest one in the book. The desire to sit on the throne and rule the crown of creation.
Hubris is standard, sure. But the mechanics of this rebellion are terrifyingly unique to Haltu's universe. When the Guardian falls, it isn't just a political shift where angels suddenly draw swords against each other.
Right, the corruption isn't just ideological, it's geological. The narrative reveals that one of the foundational stones of paradise actually goes dark.
The hardware rots.
Yes. The Guardian's emotional state is quantum entangled with the carbon structure of reality itself.
That is the crucial mechanism. Because the emeralds contain the eternal plan, and Guardian was bonded to them, his spiritual failing induces a physical rot in the hardware of the universe. An emerald going dark is essentially a localized spiritual black hole.
And the gravitational pull of that dark stone is devastating. It rips a third of the singer angels down with it. The cultural and artistic resonance of heaven is fractured in an instant.
The creator's response is immediate, and it utilizes this brilliant poetic inversion.
How so?
Well, the Guardian, who sought absolute expansion and rule, is compressed. The creator seals him inside a black, lightless stone.
Oh, wow. He becomes the anti-emerald.
Exactly. The genesis of life was breath into glowing green stones. The consequence of pride is suffocation inside a lightless void.
And this black stone is hurled like lightning into the expanses of the earth.
But here is where the narrative forces us to grapple with a deeply uncomfortable theological mechanism. The creator speaks directly to the fallen Guardian.
This part is intense.
It says, "Even you, evil, I will use to brighten the white hearts, for I know that because of you, they too will fall."
Hold on. I have to push back heavily on this. If the creator intentionally uses the Guardian's evil to brighten the pure hearts, acknowledging that humanity will fall as a direct result, doesn't that make the creator fundamentally complicit in every ounce of suffering that follows?
It's the ultimate problem of evil laid bare.
It sounds less like divine wisdom and more like a cruel, manipulative experiment.
If you view it merely as a test, it absolutely does seem cruel. But within the physics of this universe, contrast is required for actualization.
Contrast.
Think about it. A white light in a perfectly white room is invisible. It casts no shadows, defines no shapes. By allowing the black stone to exist within the system, the creator is establishing a dark background against which the free will of humanity can actually be exercised and seen.
So the argument is that without the capacity for ultimate failure, the victory of choosing love is mathematically meaningless.
Precisely. The creator isn't causing the suffering. The creator is refusing to violate the free will that makes the suffering possible, while simultaneously promising to engineer a victory out of that very darkness.
A promise immediately realized by a prophecy to send the sun to crush the head of this black serpent. But the temporary solution is deeply unsettling.
The binding of the stone.
Right. The multicolored fire angel binds the black stone in burning chains, but leaves it suspended in the realms of the air. It sounds like a ticking time bomb was deliberately placed in the Earth's atmosphere. Is the creator playing an infinitely long game of chess?
It's not buried in the Earth's core. It's not exiled to a distant galaxy. It is locked in the atmosphere, directly above the newly created humanity.
A localized atmospheric threat. It's the ultimate sword of Damocles. The cosmic war has relocated from the green server room to the airspace of Earth.
The synthesis of this section is vital. Evil in this universe isn't a rival god. It is broken hardware. It is a corrupted file that the creator deliberately leaves in the system to stress test the free will of humanity.
And to fight a war against atmospheric evil, you need localized champions on the ground, which launches us into the most jarring, structurally brilliant shift in the narrative.
It really catches you off guard.
We leave the grand mythological prose of heaven and smash cut into reality. The text says, "Thunder rumbled above the White Pearl Hospital when I was born into the world, and my mother smiled her angel smile."
If you're listening and feeling intense mental whiplash, that friction is entirely deliberate. We drop from a multicolored plasma angel wrestling a black stone in the stratosphere straight into a sterile modern hospital room.
But it's not a clean break, is it? The text overlays the two realities. While the baby is born in the hospital, the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit are holding a war council in heaven.
They are strategizing the deployment of their strongest warriors, and they refer to them as two sackcloth-clad witnesses.
The vocabulary is doing heavy lifting here. In historical and prophetic traditions, sackcloth isn't armor.
No, not at all.
It is rough, abrasive fabric worn during extreme mourning, repentance, or catastrophic grief. By designating their strongest warriors as sackcloth clad, the Trinity is guaranteeing that their lives will be defined by friction and sorrow.
Their warfare isn't swinging swords. Their warfare is bearing the agonizing weight of a broken world.
Exactly. But then the text forces us into what it calls Fantasy World Part 1. We see knights praying in a pulsating white pearl-shaped temple leaning on broadswords.
A sky crackling with patterns.
Yes. White midwives hand a screaming baby to a glowing white queen who declares him the son of thunder and an instrument of hope.
The architectural echo is brilliant. We have a white pearl hospital in the mundane reality and a white pearl temple in the fantasy reality.
This is wild. It's like we're watching a split-screen movie. On one side, it's a medical drama in a hospital. On the other is a high fantasy epic with knights leaning on hilts. Are Toiva and Elisa essentially avatars for a higher cosmic purpose?
It operates exactly like quantum superposition. The hospital and the Pearl Temple are occupying the exact same coordinates in space and time.
That's a great way to describe it.
You have the mundane medical drama layered perfectly over a high fantasy epic, and the reader is forced to observe both timelines simultaneously. Toivo, which translates to hope in Finnish, by the way, is both a screaming human infant and a prophesied weapon.
And consider the sensory experience, the violence of his arrival. Thunder, crackling skies, a pulsating temple, a screaming baby, armed knights. Hope is generally depicted as a passive, soft emotion. You know, a candle in the dark.
But here, hope is loud. It's disruptive. It shatters the status quo. Toivo represents the raw, stormy power necessary to jolt a dark world out of complacency.
The core takeaway from Toivo's birth is that genuine hope is an act of aggression against despair. It doesn't ask permission, it arrives like thunder.
But an instrument of hope needs a target. Thunder without rain just causes wildfires. We need a second warrior to complete the mechanism.
Right, because the prophecy called for two warriors. 10 years later, we are introduced to Elisa, the living rose.
Notice the total inversion of environmental modifiers here.
Yeah, it's night and day.
We move from crackling thunder and broadswords to a spring sun, a most beautiful miracle, and the cascading waters of the Seven Sisters waterfall in Geringer.
And we have to examine the real world geography here. Geringer is an actual fjord in Norway.
It's breathtaking.
The topography of a fjord is literally a massive, violent scar cut into the earth by crushing glacial ice over millennia, which is then flooded with deep, life-giving water.
That geological reality perfectly maps onto the narrative's thematic mechanism. The violence of the ice, which represents the fall, the thunder creates the capacity to hold the water, which represents the grace, the life.
Wow.
By anchoring Elisa's birth above the Seven Sisters, which is this spectacularly beautiful cascade of seven distinct streams, the author forces the cosmic myth down into the actual dirt and water of Scandinavia.
It tells the listener, this apocalyptic war isn't happening in a distant galaxy. It's happening over the Norwegian fjords.
Exactly.
So Toivo gets thunder, pulsating temples and nights. Elisa gets spring sun, roses, and waterfalls. Is the text setting up a dynamic of raw, stormy power, balancing out natural, flowing grace?
It is.
But why the 10-year gap between Toivo and Elisa? And why symbolize her specifically as the white living rose?
Well, the 10-year gap in earthly time is mathematically irrelevant when viewed from the Emerald Server Room. Remember the very first chapter.
Green-eyed bride.
Yes. The living green-eyed bride was prophesied immediately after the foundation of paradise. Elisa's existence was predestined before the concept of time was even created.
It's the ultimate elemental duality. Toivo is the thunder and lightning that shatters the hardened ground of human despair. Elisa is the water and sunlight that nourishes the broken soil to bring forth life.
You cannot defeat the dark stone with destruction alone. Toivo is the sword. Elisa is the medicine.
The synthesis here is that victory in a broken universe requires a complete ecosystem. Raw power without grace is just destruction. Grace without power is defenseless. They must be fused.
And when that fusion occurs, when the climax of this cosmic war finally detonates, we actually don't experience it from the viewpoint of Toivo or Elisa.
No, we don't.
The narrative performs a massive perspective shift down to an entirely ordinary bystander, Pastor Curry.
It's a structurally brilliant decision. If we stayed in the heavenly realm, the climax would feel untethered from human consequence. By dropping us into Pastor Kari's mind, we experience the metaphysical collision through a terribly human, deeply vulnerable lens.
The scene starts with a global activation. Temples of the White Hearts begin to shine globally.
Okay, so the network is turning on.
Right. Then, inside a normal church service, Pastor Kari is hit with an apocalyptic full sensory vision. He sees two golden roses weeping tears of blood.
We know the golden roses are the fully realized divine states of Toivo and Elisa, but the imagery of them weeping blood is critical. They aren't standing victorious over the corpse of a dragon. They are suffering.
It pays off the sackcloth-clad witnesses' prophecy perfectly. Their ultimate act of warfare isn't inflicting violence. It is enduring it.
And below these weeping roses is a terrifying void, the localized black hole of the fallen guardian's influence, filled with the reaching hands of trapped humanity.
The mechanism of salvation here is almost chemical. The moment a single drop of that blood representing ultimate sacrificial empathy makes contact with the darkness, the reaction is instantaneous and catastrophic to the dark stone structure.
A massive golden tsunami materializes, literally stamped with the word agape.
Agape. The highest, most selfless form of divine, unconditional love in ancient Greek theology. Is love not as an emotion, but as an elemental force of physics.
The golden tsunami of agape crashes into the darkness. It lifts the weeping roses and the trapped souls upward while the demons are crushed downward into a ravine, shrieking that their judgment has arrived.
The irony is amazing.
It really is. The dark pride of the guardian isn't burned away by celestial fire. It is drowned in golden water. The elemental force of selfless love proves to be denser and heavier than the elemental force of pride.
And the manifestation of this cosmic victory in the physical world is hilariously, beautifully awkward.
Right. The scene is incredibly cinematic. It's like the tears of blood are a chemical catalyst. A single drop hits the darkness and boom, a golden tidal wave of agape.
Just massive energy release.
But I have to ask about poor Pastor Kari. Imagine sitting in church and your pastor just violently snaps out of a vision, weeping hysterically, and starts shouting to a stunned congregation that a revival is born.
It brilliantly underscores the dual reality concept.
Yeah.
In the spiritual layer, the structural integrity of evil has just been vaporized by a tsunami of agape.
Yep.
But in the physical layer, a middle-aged man is having an emotional breakdown in front of a bewildered audience.
It grounds this massive cosmic event in a very human, almost humorous reality. The takeaway from Kari's vision is that the most catastrophic weapons in the universe aren't swords or fire. They are sacrifice and unconditional love.
Agape is the only force capable of fundamentally altering the physics of a corrupted reality.
With the spiritual war tipping toward victory, the final step in the Creator's eternal plan must be fulfilled, the ultimate union of the two warriors. The software patch must be permanently installed into the universe.
Which brings us to the final convergence. In heaven, the Father declares that Toivo and Elisa will be bound together by a golden chain of love forever.
Notice the deliberate counter-programming. The fire angel bound the dark stone with burning, fiery chains of suppression.
Right, bondage.
But the Creator binds the warriors with golden chains of eternal unity, bondage versus connection.
And the heavenly choir sings, promising that the agonizing tears of blood shed by Toivo and Elisa will be gathered into eternal chalices for the final harvest.
That's a beautiful detail.
Their suffering wasn't just a byproduct of the war. It is treated as a holy relic. Nothing was wasted.
The preservation of those tears validates the entire traumatic journey. It tells the reader that grief is not ignored by the architecture of the universe. It is collected and sanctified.
Then the angels blow to the four winds, and the narrative instantly collapses all this massive celestial architecture down to a single point on Earth.
A ship floating in the Jiringer Bay.
A wedding dress fluttering in the wind. Elisa's veil is caught by the breeze and drifts toward the roaring Seven Sisters waterfalls.
And as the veil lifts, the text zooms in on her face, her wide smile, and her green, soul-piercing emerald eyes radiated light.
The macro is completely mirrored in the micro. Her glowing green eyes perfectly map back to the very first sentence of the text.
The Creator breathing into the green emerald foundations of paradise.
Exactly. The entire vast cosmic architecture, the server room of destiny, the multicolored fire angels, the atmospheric black stones, the golden tsunamis, it is all perfectly compressed and reflected in the eyes of one woman standing on a boat in Norway.
She says, "I do." Toivo takes her hand, and a diamond on her finger refracts the light from a rainbow cast by the waterfall.
The elemental convergence is absolute perfection here.
Right, break it down.
We have the water of the bay and the waterfall, the air blowing the veil, the earth compressed into the diamond, and the rainbow echoing the green arc covenant made before time began.
And the final element, spirit. Jesus appears, placing his hands over theirs, sealing the eternal union, and finally fulfilling the ancient prophecy to crush the black serpent.
It's just a masterclass in narrative scaling.
Here's what I love about this ending. We started with giant fire angels and cosmic betrayals, and we end on the deck of a ship with a veil blowing in the wind. Why does the text shrink these massive universe-ending stakes down to a single intimate moment of two people holding hands?
Because within the physics of Haltu's universe, the intimate and the cosmic are the exact same thing.
Explain that.
The unconditional love between two people isn't just an event occurring inside the universe. It is the structural integrity that holds the universe together. When Toivo and Elisa join hands, they are physically maintaining the fabric of reality.
It's a breathtaking perspective shift. Let's synthesize this journey for you, our learner. We witnessed a universe born not from a sterile command, but from biological emerald breath.
We analyzed the catastrophic risk of encoding free will into a localized security apparatus,
which resulted in a dark stone of pride corrupting the system. We experienced the quantum superposition of Toivo and Elisa's births, the duality of violence and grace.
We saw the structural power of evil utterly liquefied by a chemical reaction of agape and tears of blood.
And it all finalized in a localized elemental wedding that stitched the torn cosmos back together.
It is a narrative that weaponizes abstract theology to explain deeply human concepts. It argues that love isn't a fleeting biological neurochemical response.
No, bigger than that.
It is a fundamental law of physics, heavier and denser than gravity or despair.
And that leaves us with a lingering, provocative thought to close out on. The Creator explicitly told the fallen guardian, even you, evil, I will use to brighten the white heart.
Right, the contrast.
The universe required the contrast of that black stone to force the green emeralds to shine at their maximum capacity.
Because without the resistance, the agape wave could never have been generated.
Exactly. It suggests that without the darkness, the light of those emeralds and the love between Toivo and Elisa could never truly be seen. It makes you wonder about the architecture of our own reality.
In what way?
When we are caught in our own muddy waters, dealing with pain or friction that seems utterly senseless, are our deepest struggles actually precise, localized mechanisms engineered to generate the contrast needed for our eventual triumphs to shine the brightest?
It fundamentally reframes how we experience adversity.
Are our tears currently filling an eternal chalice? Thank you for going down this rabbit hole with us today. Until next time, keep questioning the narrative, keep looking for the connections, and see if you can spot the green emeralds hidden in the blueprint of your own life.